Hi, this is May Breakout, host of the Scott Sigler fanfiction podcast, Junkie May's Chop Shop. You can find me and my show at www.junkiemayschopshop.com. And now, you're listening to episode 35 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, The Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hello and welcome to episode 35. It's been 2 weeks, but we're finally here. I'm going to be a little more subdued tonight because it's late. My family's asleep, and I'm not down in my studio. I'm upstairs just talking on my H2 here. So I've got a lot of news today, including a new contest, a new promo for Murder at Avedon Hill, and a bit of info on the next podcast project I'm really happy to be part of. But I'll leave that for after the chapter. First, I want to thank May Breakall for the intro. Scott Sigler has had a lot of firsts in podcasting, and Junkie May's Chop Shop is another first. It is the first podcast delivering fan fiction dedicated to an existing podcast fiction author. Yeah, Scott Sigler. There's also a rumor that my short story, Death, Taxes, and Scott Sigler, will make an appearance on that podcast at some point. I also want to thank Mer Lafferty for this episode's story so far. I Should Be Writing is still the single podcast I never miss, and you shouldn't miss it either. Also appearing in this episode are The Vicar from Geek Radio Daily, Jay Lynn from Metamediocrity.com, Podcasting's Rich Siegfried from Mr. Adventure and many other shows over at OutcastMultimedia.com, and Jack Hosley from WanderRadio.com. There is one item I want to mention before the start of the episode. In this chapter, there is a discussion of something that is drawn. It is described a bit during the narrative, but there is a drawing that accompanies this description in the novel, and that drawing is available on the website in the show notes for this episode. Also, our resident artist Natalie Metzger has contributed a new piece that represents what Aramis imagines happened earlier that night. Both of these drawings are clues that will become much clearer in episodes to come. Episode 35 is a long one, so let's get to it. Cue up Ms. Lafferty, we got an episode to put on here.
Hi, this is Mer Lafferty of the novel Playing for Keeps, the audio drama The Takeover, and the podcast I Should Be Writing, all of which can be found at www.merverse.com. And here is the story so far for episode 35 of Murder at Avedon Hill. Entering the third day of their investigation, Aramis Cragan and Aaron Perty have managed to clear many of Avedon Hill's townspeople of Greta Platt's murder. Recently, however, several townspeople are being more than ruled out. They are turning up dead. First, there is Edward Avedon, murdered by Lane Nichols. The vampire may have escaped Avedon Hill, but she is on the run, closely tracked by resident undead hunter Father Joris. Next, we have Talik Bor, the innkeeper, once a suspect in Greta's murder. Talik was killed by the moon beast Rondellus Marks in the mountains east of town, just before Rondellus was in turn destroyed by Aaron Perty. In episode 34, Aramis and Aaron finally get the chance for some well-needed sleep. Aramis is visited once more by his former ironic brother, Gareth Beckwin, this time in a dream. Meanwhile, Aaron dreams of Avedon Manor and the death of Greta Platt's mother, Gloria. Episode 34 ends with Aramis realizing that Aaron's dream walks are becoming more powerful and more prescient, as Constable Ulrich notifies them that Gloria Platt's body has been discovered at the town's theater.
And now, episode 35 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Chapter 35, Death at the Theater. The icon of Dauphin, child of trickery. Death strikes the mother as swiftly as the father. Balin strives to save them. But once the children return, the loss of the mother will mark the end of the age. Third Collected Prophecies of Iberian, Book 2, Chapter 2.
Aramis stood over the corpse of Gloria Platt. She still wore the blue dress he had seen on her the day before. Moments before, Aramis had touched the undamaged side of her neck and face. Judging by the temperature of her skin, Aramis assumed that Gloria Platt had been murdered at least 3 psychs before she had been discovered. Father Livingstone now prayed over the body of Greta's mother. "Father Livingstone, please be careful as you stand up. We cannot afford to disturb the area around her body." For the first time, the young cleric had a fire in his eyes.
"Don't bother me now, Sir Aramis."
Aramis raised his eyebrows, simply nodded and moved over to the other men in the theater. Constable Lewis, Constable Tanner, and Herr Jarr, the blacksmith. "Who found her?" The large half-taurim stepped forward.
"I did, Sir Aramis. I was collecting some tools."
"Tools?"
"Yes. Lord Avedon had asked Olus to do some repair work on the theater. He wanted to start having some concerts here again."
The head constable corroborated his statement.
"That was before Greta was killed. Greta and Sarah Tremaine used to sing here every season until 2 years ago. Lord Avedon asked the two of them to sing here again. Their first concert was going to be next Lunas."
Aramis nodded. "Yes, Karen Avedon told Aaron as much the other day." Herr Jarr continued.
"Olus left one of my hammers here. I needed it, so I came over to pick it up."
"Do you make a habit of walking through town at dawn?" Herr Jarr looked confused, then pointed to a very thin hammer hanging from his belt.
"No, I stopped my work last night because I needed this for some detail work. I woke up early and came here to retrieve it. I didn't feel like waiting for Olus to arrive this morning. Didn't want to waste half a day waiting on a tool that I could get myself."
"Did you move the body at all, or see anything else?"
"I only touched her face to see if she was still alive."
Tears welled up in the blacksmith's eyes. "Okay, Herr Jarr. Unless Constable Lewis has need of you, please go back to the smithy, and we will come by later if we need to talk." Lewis nodded towards the door, indicating that Herr Jarr should go. Before Herr Jarr left, however, he said,
"She's got the marks, doesn't she? She was killed by the vampire."
Aramis did not respond, instead allowing Lewis to lead Herr Jarr out the door of the theater. While Father Livingstone continued his transition of Gloria's soul to Callan's Abyss, Aramis asked Aaron to search the perimeter of the theater, both the interior and the exterior of the building. A few moments later, Lewis returned and Aramis pulled him aside. "You spoke to Lord Avedon last night."
"Yes. He was unhappy about Talik's murder, of course, but glad that you had dispatched the Moonbeast. He wants to know why you believe Rondellus could not have been Greta's murderer."
"From the conversation we overheard between Rondellus and Talik, it was clear that Rondellus Marx had not entered town at any point. He expected Talik to get him and his carnival into Avedon Hill legally. What he planned on doing once the carnival gained entry to Avedon Hill will always remain a mystery." Lewis removed his hat and ran his fingers through his hair. He then turned to Constable Tanner.
"Please help Aaron search the perimeter of the theater for signs of a struggle or anything else of interest."
Tanner curtly nodded and immediately left the theater. Even though they were now alone, Lewis leaned in close to the monk so no one else could overhear.
"Sir Aramis, I have faith in you and your abilities. I know that I would not have survived encounters with vampires and moonbeasts, but I also know when Lord Avedon keeps things from me. Will you tell me what's going on? I'm worried about the children, especially Edward.
Aramis could not lie, so he could not answer. Why are you worried about the children?
The children, they've always been under my care. Since Greta's murder, Lord Avedon has kept all but Julianne and John away from me, and I'm sure none of the children, even Richard, will be allowed to leave the manor now that Talic Bor and Gloria Platt have been murdered. Edward has always been prone to illness, but he's been sick for far too long, and no one will tell me what's wrong with him. It's just not like them.
Aramis felt for the man. He himself had at one time been the primary custodian over the grandchildren of the King of Yew, and understood what it was like to be kept in the dark about events that directly affected those under his care. I am sorry, Lewis. All I can say is that Lord Avedon feels that he has everything under control when it comes to the safety of his children. You need to speak to him if you want to know exactly what is going on in that manner. Lewis closed his eyes for a moment. Aramis could see Lewis's eyeballs move left and right underneath his eyelids as he contemplated what to do next. Finally, the head constable leaned back and opened his eyes, apparently resigned to move on to the task at hand.
So what do you make of this?
Aramis took his eyes off of Lewis for a moment. Father Livingston had completed his ritual. Let us take a closer look, Lewis. After a hasty apology to Aramis, Father Livingston took his leave. Before the cleric left, the head constable promised that his men would bring Gloria's body to the temple once Aramis was done. Aramis Cragan squatted down close to Gloria's corpse, careful not to disturb the wooden floor around Gloria's body. These wounds, they are the same marks you saw on Greta's neck. Lewis did not need to look again.
Yes, they're the same.
Doesn't appear to be Lane's work, now does it? Aramis referred to the marks left on the neck of the book dealer Lane Nichols had killed the night of Greta's murder. Lewis shuddered, as if he had still not fully accepted that the quiet and seemingly kind librarian was a creature capable of murder.
No, it doesn't. Too clean to be a vampire bite. Isn't that your theory?
Not the one we have both met, in any case. Aramis pulled out his notebook, opening it first to the page that had the three impressions made by the gardening fork sold at the general store. One possibility Aramis had to consider was that the broken piece of metal found in the manor courtyard had come from a gardening tool of some sort, and that this tool might have been the instrument of Greta's death. It did not explain the lack of blood found on or around the young housemistress, but it was a theory. The marks on Gloria's neck, however, did not match the drawing enough to consider it a match to the tool sold by Alex de Weirin. Aramis flipped the pages of his notebook until he reached the impressions of Edward's teeth. Hiding the page from Lewis's view, Aramis compared the distance between Edward's incisors to the marks on Gloria's neck. This could be a match, but again, these wounds are so clean. If Edward murdered Greta as his first kill as a vampire, Greta's wounds could be explained as a first tentative kill, but if Gloria Platt was Edward's second kill, this wound does not seem right. There should be more damage to the skin around the wound. The small pool of blood here. Aramis pointed to the ground to the left of Gloria's head. This is more than was found in the courtyard.
Yes, but even that pool of blood is less than we found on or around the body of the man we examined in the woods yesterday, correct?
Aramis nodded. A vampire can drain a lot of blood, but in most of the cases I have studied, there was still a lot of blood found on or near the body, similar to what we found on the book dealer's clothes. Sir Aramis, I found a few drops of blood leading from that side door of the theater to, well, near to what Constable Tanner has identified as another entrance to the underground tunnel system. This is becoming absurd. At every turn, someone is using one of these tunnels, either to evade us or to perform some unsavory activity. How large exactly is this network of tunnels underneath the town?
The tunnels were originally dug as the town was being built. The Avedon Mining Company had competitors. It's said that several went so far as to hire mercenaries to attack the settlement that was growing here. Before the outer wall was constructed, several underground shelters were built, connected by tunnels to the workers' homes. This gave the miners' wives and children the ability to hide during any mercenary or bandit attacks. Eventually, the miners connected the shelters to the other shafts, providing the townspeople the ability to escape an attack by making their way to the grounds behind the manor.
Who in the town knows these tunnels well enough to use them to get around?
My constables, Lord Avedon, Richard and Edward, and Kel, the manor caretaker. Some of the other townspeople know about certain tunnels, like Lane, who was given access to the tunnel between the library and her home. Hemming the baker has a secret tunnel entrance hidden near his bakery that his family could use to get to the safety of the area behind the manor.
Talek had one as well.
Yes, but that tunnel was only supposed to connect his inn to the main tunnel that leads to the underground gate behind the manor. Neither I nor Lord Avedon realized any of these tunnels led outside of town. It doesn't make sense. The tunnels were built so townspeople could escape an attack on the town from the south. No one would have built a passage that would give outsiders unfettered access to the town.
What about Father Joris?
Joris? Well, he certainly knows about them, but he was never given access to them by Lord Avedon.
Aramis remembered how the old cleric had acted in the tunnel that connected the library to Lane Nichols' home. While he did not immediately know which way to go, he certainly was not surprised by the tunnel. And the Platts. Lewis looked down at Gloria Platt's corpse.
Yes, of course. The housemistress knew the tunnel system inside and out. Greta, most of all. Once the weather turned or on rainy days, she would use the underground passages rather than walk outside.
Aramis carefully opened one of the pockets on the front of Gloria's dress. He pulled out a key. To her home, Lewis?
That's the right sort of key, yes.
Two of the manor guards, including Rock, had made it to the theater. Lewis, please post these two guards here and tell them not to disturb anything. We need to go. Constable Tanner, would you please open the tunnel door? Aaron had led Aramis outside the theater and had shown him the blood droplets on the grass and in the dirt. Constable Tanner looked over to Head Constable Lewis, waiting for a signal. Lewis nodded, and immediately Constable Tanner felt around a well-groomed circle of grass until he found a handle obscured by the blades of grass. Does Kel keep this area's grass as well? Aramis remembered the secret door he and Aaron had used to enter the tunnels north of the stables, and how well hidden the entrance had been. Lewis nodded again.
Yes, he's responsible for keeping these doors hidden by grass or other landscaping.
Lewis, if you are willing, I would like you to take Constable Tanner and Aaron through that passage directly to Gloria Platt's house. Look for any visual proof that Gloria's murderer used the tunnel to transport her body to the theater. I will proceed to the house above ground and see if this key fits her door. The key opened the door to the Platt home, and as he had hoped, it allowed Aramis access to the small dwelling before Lewis and the others arrived. The main living area that Aramis had seen the night before was in complete disarray. Furniture had been moved, a bookcase had been overturned, and the chair that Gloria had sat in during his short visit was on its side with one of its legs broken. Aramis spotted a bloodstain on the center rug by the overturned chair, and he spied a second and larger pool of blood nearby on the wood floor. Aramis approached the bloodstains and determined this was the site of Gloria Platt's murder. Still, not enough blood. I am sorry, Gloria. I misjudged how dangerous this was for you. I will keep my promise and bring your daughter back to you, so you can lie by her side, if nothing else. Something caught Aramis's eye as he lingered near the bloodstained rug, but before he could study it further, he heard a muffled moan coming from the next room. Aramis rushed in and discovered Kel lying on the floor near Gloria Platt's bed, a fire poker at his side. He was dressed for sleep, and there was a great deal of blood in his hair and dried to his face. At the same time, a trap door on the floor on the other side of the bedroom swung open. Constable Lewis's head popped through the hole as he climbed up. He saw Aramis and began with,
"We found more blood droplets in the tunnel, but it..."
Lewis stopped as he saw Kel. Aramis studied Kel's wounds as the groundskeeper continued to moan groggily. There was a deep gash to his forehead, making a bloody mess of his face, but the wound looked far worse than it actually was. Aramis found a clean cloth and applied pressure to the wound. He then helped Kel sit up. Kel, can you hear me? Aaron passed another cloth, soaked in water. Aramis used it to clean some of the blood from Kel's face. From the corner of his eye, Aramis Cragen saw Tanner start into the next room. Tanner, there are at least two bloodstains on the floor in there. Stand clear of them, but look around for anything else that might help us. Those words seemed to snap Kel out of his stupor. He began to yell and clawed at Aramis's arms. Aramis pulled Kel to his feet and sat him on the edge of Gloria's bed. Kel,
the thing.
Please, it is over. Kel finally recognized Aramis and stopped his struggles.
It attacked us, the thing. It was a vampire just like Father Jorce warned us about.
Kel had made it very clear that he shared Father Jorce's views on the evils in and around Avedon Hill. What exactly did you see? For the first time, Kel noticed that he was dressed in his night clothes and began to stand in search of a robe. Lewis was at Aramis's side and prevented Kel from standing up.
No, Kel, you need to hold this cloth until we can get you taken care of. That wound requires sewing.
Aramis pushed forward. Kel, I need you to concentrate. What happened here? Kel looked around, mulling over the events in his mind before he spoke.
I was in here, asleep.
Despite all the blood, Aramis could tell that Kel's face reddened. Constable Lewis still had his hand on Kel's shoulder and now patted it.
Kel, we all knew that you and Miss Gloria had a relationship. We half expected you to retire and leave Avedon Hill with her once Greta took over as housemistress.
Kel began to cry.
I wanted to. Gloria wouldn't let me. Told me my life was here, not with her.
Tears escaped Kel's eyes.
Gloria's dead, isn't she?
Aramis, still at eye level with Kel, confirmed his worst fears. Again, I need you to focus, Kel. We need your help. Kel closed his eyes for a moment, then spoke.
I was asleep in here. Gloria was sitting by the fire when I went to bed. She still refused to sleep. I woke up sometime in the night, hearing a ruckus in the next room. I found her on the floor, on her stomach, holding her neck. She was still alive.
You went to her side. The groundskeeper nodded. Did you bend down to her? Did you touch her?
No, I couldn't move. I just stood there staring at her. But then I heard something behind me, some sort of an animal hiss. I turned and it ran into the bedroom. It was surrounded by darkness.
Lewis interrupted.
What do you mean by that, Kel?
Aramis remembered the darkness that had filled their room at the inn when something or someone attacked Aaron in his sleep. The darkness moved with the creature, like a cloud of smoke.
Yes, that's it. I grabbed the poker from the fireplace and ran after it. Then I got into the bedroom. The darkness was all around me. I couldn't see anything, even though I had left candles lit in the room. I swung the poker in all directions, but I didn't hit anything but the wall. I ran into the edge of the bed and lost my balance. Then the creature hit me. It felt like a mace or a hammer. That's the last thing I remember.
Are you okay to walk? A few moments later, they stood in the living room. Tanner indicated that he had found nothing in particular.
It looked like the vampire was searching for something.
Kel gasped when he saw that Gloria was gone. It appears that the murderer attacked Gloria first, and then ransacked this room. After knocking you out, he picked Gloria up and used the tunnel to escape. Kel, where did you step when you came into the room? Aramis held up a hand as Kel attempted to move forward. No, please, just tell me. Aramis moved over to the side opposite to where Gloria had bled from her neck. Here. You never moved to that side where the blood is on the floor. Another nod from Kel. Good. You are in your bare feet. Show me their bottoms. Kel, with Lewis's assistance, lifted his feet one at a time and showed them to Aramis. They were dirty, but nearly blood-free. Where are your boots, Kel? Kel pointed.
Over there, by the door.
Aaron, closer to the home's entrance, had already seen where Aramis was going with this. He walked over and lifted the boots, examining their soles. No blood here. Kel's hand dropped from his forehead.
What is this? What are you doing?
Lewis grabbed Kel's arm and forced him to continue applying pressure to his head wound.
Stop it, Kel. He's doing what must be done. Look.
The head constable pointed to the carpet where Gloria's head might have lain. On it was a large, bloody boot print. Aramis moved a step to his right and pointed to another spot on the carpet. This is even more interesting. Lewis, please, come here. Lewis left Kel with Constable Tanner, moved over, and dropped to one knee, studying the area where Aramis pointed.
What is that?
Aramis pulled out his notebook and began drawing. I believe that was Gloria Platt's last act. Head Constable Lewis studied the dark swirls of color on the carpet.
By the children, she drew that with her own blood, didn't she?
Aramis had finished his own interpretation of the blood-stained carpet and held it out for Lewis to see. This look right to you? Lewis nodded. If my theory is correct, she did this while her attacker dealt with Kel in the next room. Kel began to shake.
Why didn't the vampire just kill me as well? And why did it take Gloria to you said the theater?
I'm sorry, Kel, but I don't think Gloria was killed by a vampire. And as for... The old gardener didn't let Aramis finish.
Not a vampire? I saw the marks on her neck! The creature was here! I saw it!
Aramis approached the groundskeeper. He took the man by the shoulders until Kel's shaking subsided. Kel, you told us yourself. Did you actually see the monster, or only the cloud of darkness that surrounded him? Or her?
I saw it was large. It had to be a vampire.
Kel broke down, tears streaming down his blood-stained face.
I didn't see it. It was all shadows, like a cloak made of the Turkish smoke. Just because I didn't see it, it doesn't mean it wasn't a vampire. Father Joris has told me stories of vampires. A vampire master could do this. Couldn't it?
In theory, Kel. And though I am only working on theories as well, I do not believe Gloria Platt and her daughter were attacked by a vampire, master or no. Aramis turned to Lewis, head constable. An event occurred the other night. At the time, I decided it was not best to share it with you. I was wrong. But I will attend to that now. Aaron and I were attacked in our room 2 nights ago by something that possessed the ability to engulf the room in darkness. Aaron, please. Aaron approached and pulled back his hood, exposing his nearly healed neck. Whatever or whoever it was, it attacked Aaron and gave him this wound. Aaron lost some blood, but I countered the darkness causing Aaron's attacker to flee. Father Joris was consulted and he called it a vampire attack. But Aaron's wounds matched the wounds on both of the plots. And at this time, I still do not believe this to be a bite of a vampire. Thank you, Aaron. Aaron pulled his hood forward, covering his blonde hair. Lewis was not pleased to hear this new information.
Why did you not tell me this? We could have done something, possibly save Talik and Gloria.
Anger flashed in Kel's eyes at Lewis's words. But once he got past the idea that Gloria might have been saved, he processed the second half of Lewis's statement.
Talik too?
Aramis shook his head. Kel, Talik Bor was killed by a man named Rondellus Marx outside of town last night, not by a vampire. Focusing on Lewis, Aramis continued. I should have told you, and I regret that I did not. But it would not have made a difference with what happened tonight. I warned Gloria myself, asked her to seek the protection of the manor. She refused. Lewis turned to his constable, unsatisfied with Aramis's reasoning.
Tanner, find Ulrich and begin rounding up some of the reserve militia. Bacchus, Randall, Graves.
Nurum still has his bad ankle, but his son will want to join us.
Tell them to dress for tunnel work.
Tanner turned on his heel, grim determination on his face. Aramis realized for the first time that Tanner would follow any order delivered by his head constable. Aramis was unpleased with this turn of events, but did nothing to prevent Lewis from going down this path of investigation. Lewis had gone too long without being in control of the events around him. Do you have a cobbler here?
No, not specifically. Alex does some repair work and sells most of the boots the townspeople would wear. Sarah Tremaine has also been known to stock some higher quality footwear.
Aramis pulled out his paring knife and began working on the carpet. Moments later, he stood and handed Lewis a square of carpet around the size of Lewis's chest. At its center was the best boot print left by Gloria Platt's attacker. See if this matches some specific boot sold by either of them. You will at least have a good idea of the size of foot we are dealing with. Lewis commented to no one in particular.
Too large for most women, at least. I'll do that as soon as I get two parties into the tunnels. Now what about the drawing?
Aramis stared at the page in his notebook. I do not know what it is. It is not a letter from any alphabet I know. Maybe it is part of something larger. This center area here might have been smudged. Possibly Gloria died while drawing it, or it was damaged when the killer picked her up. Kel began to cry again. Aramis decided it was time to get him out of the house. Aaron, please wait for Kel to get dressed and take him over to the temple. Father Livingstone can tend to his wound. Lewis nodded, agreeing with Aramis's assessment. Aramis walked over to Aaron and tore the page out of his notebook with the drawing. Once Father Livingstone has seen to Kel, show him this and ask him if he knows what it is. Make sure Kel is otherwise occupied when you do this. Why? Aramis smiled. All in good time. Wait for me at the inn once you are done. Aramis turned back to the head constable. Lewis, do what you must with regards to searching the tunnels. Search for signs of use. Start your two parties on opposite sides of town.
So they won't be confused by the other party's tracks. Good. And what are you going to do?
Aramis looked over the room once more. I want to see if Father Joris has returned from his search for Lane Nichols. Okay, thanks for sticking around. First off, I want to announce that our second contest starts right now. The first contest was a big success. Murder at Avedon Hill moved up almost to the front page of the literature section of iTunes, and we received enough Caroline phone calls that we actually had two listener feedback shows. So here's how to qualify. If you leave a review on iTunes for Murder at Avedon Hill, you get one entry into the contest. If you leave a message on the Karen line, and that's at 704-315-5884, you get an entry into the contest. And that's one entry max for this particular option. And for this second contest, if you rate Murder at Avedon Hill on patiobooks.com, you're going to get a separate entry into the contest. So that's three ways to qualify. And in order to do the second part of qualifying, you've got to send me an email letting me know what you've done to qualify so I can get you entered into the contest. I can't track all this stuff myself, and I'm not even going to try. And since voting on Patio Books is anonymous, I'm just going to be trusting you guys on that piece of it. And please, just send me an email and we'll get you in. And what do you get for winning? I'll be giving away three signed copies of the novel and a Murder at Avedon Hill t-shirt from Spreadshirt.com. So that'll be four winners. And if I get 20 reviews on iTunes by December 1st, I'll add more prizes to the mix, just like I did last time. I'll post more about this on the website with all the pertinent details, but if you have any questions, please ping me on Twitter or send me an email. I'm not going to lie to you, this is a direct attempt to get Murder at Avedon Hill on the front page of the literature section of iTunes. I don't push for donations or promote the sale of the novel through my site too often, so this is my one help me out for this upcoming holiday season. Make me proud, and maybe win something in the process. Next, we have a new promo for Murder at Avedon Hill, thanks to the work of Michael Spence from Brother Osric's Scriptorium. He wrote the primary script for the promo, and I'm going to play it right now. This is the clean version of the promo. There is a particular word bleeped out at the beginning of the promo. If you are a podcaster and are willing to play this promo on your podcast, both the clean and explicit versions of the promo are available on the front page of the website. So here's the promo.
Fans of mystery and fantasy agree, Murder at Avedon Hill rocks. Mark Yoshimoto Nemkov, author of the Parsec Award-winning Number One with a Bullet, says, "With Murder at Avedon Hill, P.G. Holyfield creates a mysterious world full of twists and creatures worth diving into. Head first." T. Morris, creator of the Billabub Baddings mysteries, notes, "P.G. Holyfield creates a realm rich in its culture and lore, and then shatters its sweet innocence with a murder that begs to be solved." Seth Harwood, author of the Jack Palms crime series, says, "P.G. Holyfield is one of the best podcast fiction writers out here. Listen to this book, and you'll never turn back." And Michael Spence of Brother Osric's Scriptorium sums it up this way. "If you enjoy the kind of hard-headed sleuthing practiced in a world without modern forensics, you'll like watching Aramis Cragen and his protege Aaron pursue their investigation in the intriguing and, thanks to a talented cast of voice artists, colorfully populated village of Avedon Hill. Avedon Hill has many secrets, and some of them have been revealed. But as an undead hunter's fears are vindicated, and as a family does everything in its power to protect its way of life, Greta Platt's killer remains a mystery. With Murder at Avedon Hill moving into its stretch run, now is the perfect time to try the finalist for Best Podcast Novel at the 2008 Fall Podcast Peer Awards. A story of fantasy and mystery, of magic and spirit, which author Scott Roche says owes as much to Agatha Christie as to J.R.R. Tolkien. Subscribe now at iTunes, through patiobooks.com, or through the podcast website at pgholyfield.com. A killer is afoot. Divine powers walk across Cairn. And for the town of Avedon Hill, a battle hundreds of years in the making is coming to a head. Stop on by. You won't want to miss it when the children come out to play.
Anyone that listens to podcast fiction should recognize the voice in the promo. Patrick McLean from the Shaughnessy podcast narrated the promo, and that leads directly into my next announcement. I recently had the honor of working with Patrick on a new project that will be appearing soon on the Shaughnessy. He's definitely the creative force behind the project, but I believe I contributed enough to get a writing credit, and I am in it too. I can't say much more about it right now, except it has to do with golf and the impending apocalypse. And it's a comedy. More on that soon. Oh, I almost forgot. This weekend I'll be in Richmond, Virginia for the Geek Radio Daily annual pub crawl. I'll put a link in the show notes to more information on the event, but if you live near Richmond and want to have a beer with me Saturday night, I'll be there with at least six of the character voices for Murder at Avedon Hill. It's going to be a fun time. Come on out. We're going to close with a voicemail that I missed from last month. It is from Justin from Oregon, and it is a direct response to the question I posed at the end of episode 32, I think, whether or not the extra effects worked or became a distraction in episode 32. After that, I'm including a promo for Phil Rossi's Notes from the Vault podcast, and I'm signing off after that, so have a great week. Bye.
Hey, PG. This is Justin from Oregon. I listened to the episode today with all the fancy sounds and music, and I wanted to say that I thought it was perfect. All the sounds were right on, and you cliffhangered me. I don't like you anymore, but can't wait for the next episode. I'll even wait a little bit longer if you put all the extra sounds in. I think it was worth it. Thanks. Bye.
Spider went up the wall. Down came the rain and washed the spider out. Out came the sunshine
Please,
and dried
no.
up all
no.
the rain. And the itty bitty spider went up the spout again.
Notes from the Vault. A short fiction collection by Phil Rossi, featuring all new Crescent vignettes, as well as other stories. Visit www.crescentstation.net for details. In 2007, he scared you. In 2008, Phil Rossi will drive you insane.
Oh, oh no!
You've been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this podcast and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through magnatune.com, Kevin McLeod through incompetech.com, and David Beard through davidbeardmusic.com. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave a review at iTunes and on patiobooks.com. And become part of the show by leaving a message on the Karen line at 704-315-5884. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008, P.G. Holyfield, and is released under a Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works, 3.5 U.S. license.